Talks FM presents a lecture organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled Vanity, Profanity and Worship. The talk is delivered by Professor Anthony Buonanno.
Good afternoon. Thank you for attending this evening's lecture, which is titled Sacred or Profane, Prehistoric and Ancient Pendants from the Maltese Islands. Our distinguished speaker tonight hardly needs any introduction. Anthony Buonanno, Professor of Archaeology at the University of Malta, where he has lectured in archaeology and classics since 1971. He has also conducted lecturing visits to various universities in Europe, the United States, Zimbabwe and Egypt. Besides being a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries of London, he has also been appointed corresponding member of the Institutum Archaeologicum Germanicum and of the Archaeological Institute of America. He has served on various national boards and committees, including the Planning Authority, Heritage Malta, and the Scientific Committee for the Conservation of the Megalithic Temples. He has authored various publications on Roman art and Maltese archaeology. Before passing on to commence the lecture, a little announcement if you would kindly bear with me. Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum is currently recruiting volunteers, so if you would like to be involved in museum activities and feel you have the time to spare, please do get in touch. And now, without further ado, I will pass the word to Professor Buonanno.
Okay, let me give you a sort of preview of what I'm going to try to cover. You have to bear with me for the first three or four slides, which are text, but after that it will be objects pleasant to look at, with of course captions to help you get a better idea of what my pronunciation some difficult names in order to be able to interpret them and read them for yourselves. I should also refer to methodological criteria and which we apply to identify amulets as opposed to trinkets, which fit in also within this modern object. I have a good selection of photographs. Some of them are mine. The worst ones, the better ones I owe to Dane Lucilia, to the courtesy of Dane Lucilia, as well as the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti, some objects that are taken from the catalogue, as well as Heritage Malta. I'm grateful to these entities and persons for their kindness. So I shall start with definitions, because I always like to make clear what definitions, the purpose and otherwise of what we mean. In fact, the subject, the title of the talk has a number of items which will be defined, which that will be followed by definitions given by dictionaries of what is profane in these terms, in terms of pendants, and what is sacred and therefore amulets. And then after that it will be first a selection, a very small selection of prehistoric amulets, after that selection of Phoenician Punic amulets, and finally only a couple, unfortunately we don't have much choice, of Roman amulets. So we start with the definition of a pendant. I think it's quite obvious what it is, but let us make sure that we understand what it is. Pendants stand for small pieces of personal ornaments, normally perforated or provided with a loop for hanging. They could be worn as earrings or attached to necklaces, rings even, or brooches. Now I want to distinguish between the profane and the sacred. The best word that I could find for that element of jewelry which is not intended to be sacred in any way or magical is trinket. And trinket is defined by the shorter Oxford Dictionary, and those who are familiar with the shorter Oxford Dictionary know that it is not short at all. It is quite a monumental work. The definition found in the shorter Oxford Dictionary, a Saudi, is a small ornament, usually an article of jewelry, and it is appropriate, it fits in very well with the exhibition running just now, ongoing right now, and article of jewelry for personal ornament, therefore just for personal ornament, therefore profane. Of course, the modern object next here, illustrated here, could be just a personal, could be just a trinket, a personal ornament, you know, for aesthetic purposes. It's gold, all right, and coral, therefore precious, precious materials. But it has this sign, this iconography, which places it in a different level, and that magical or sacred. So, like other pieces of jewelry, including necklaces, brooches, rings, even bracelets and armlets, pendants can be worn purely for physical enhancement. In other words, for aesthetic purposes. In this case, they are valued for their inherent beauty deriving from the material, gold, precious stone, and or craftsmanship. This satisfies both. They can be worn as a mark of social status, especially if they are expensive. They expose the wearer to a higher status in society. Of course, the more exotic, more expensive, and the more artistically wrought the object, the higher is the status, social status of the wearer. Now we go on to the other typology, that of amulet, and again the same dictionary defines it as anything worn as a charm against evil, against disease, and against witchcraft. So here we enter into a different world, the world of the sacred or magical. So what makes the pendants amulets is their presumed power over good or evil forces. They become sacred objects if they invoke the power of religious beings, like deities and supernatural spirits. In the Greek word for the latter is daimones or daimones. Then they assume a magical role as opposed to just sacred if by them the owner believes to have direct power over external forces. One must admit that in antiquity these two roles overlapped each other, and the fine line separating them is often very blurred and also non-existent. I would also distinguish those amulets that are apotropaic, that's the word that I used for the article in the same vein, the same subject, published in Treasures of Malta, apotropaic, apotropaica. I would also distinguish amulets that are apotropaic, that is intended to ward off evil, from talismanic ones. That is, I would like to see the positive side in the talisman, that is intended to favor good health and well-being. Just a word about the methodology for identifying amulets as opposed to simple trinkets, simple jewelry. And here, of course, I can't help giving you the archaeological perspective. We start off with prehistoric amulets. we start by saying that for prehistory, this is evident. We have no textual evidence. By definition, prehistory is that whole period of existence, human existence, before the introduction of writing. Okay, so we don't have any person telling us what the meaning of objects is. But we can make up for that. We have the material, often inexpensive for prehistory, shells, seashells, even bones, animal bones, and animal teeth. Then, of course, the iconography, which is a little bit more explicit, especially the shape, which could be anthropomorphic. If the shape of the amulet is anthropomorphic, then the likelihood is that it has some higher meaning, symbolical meaning, and even sexual connotations. I shall not be illustrating the seashells, but later on I shall indicate one. A cowrie shell, for example, has also female sexual connotations. All right, and therefore, if we can determine that it is a pendant, it is likely that it has also the value of an amulet. And of course, the context is for archaeology is essential, is indispensable. That is why when objects turn up in museums and in private collections without the original archaeological context, they lose 99% of their value. Context is extremely valuable. So I have divided the different types of context that we find these objects in domestic, these houses, very few for the whole of our prehistory, especially for the temple period where we miss them most. Where did our temple builders live? I mean, we have these extraordinary structures, but we have few or next to nothing in terms of domestic architecture. They could be cultic, I mean, places of worship, right? Temples, shrines, in which case they would normally fall under the term offerings or votive offerings within the cultic context, or else in funerary context. In antiquity, people used to bury grave goods, objects belonging to the person, personal ornaments, along with the deceased body. We no longer do that because, of course, we prefer to pass them on to later generations. A brief idea of the chronology of Maltese archaeology, starting from prehistory. This is a timeline. I'd like you to go over it very quickly, starting from the left. The earliest presence in Malta, going back of human presence in Malta, going back to about 5,000 BC, about 7,000 years ago. We have first Maltese prehistory is divided into three periods. The first period is the earlier Neolithic, okay, followed by the Temple period, the period during which our wonderful constructions were built, our temples were built, and then followed by the Bronze, which incorporates also 100 years or so of Iron Age. You have what was happening at the same time in other parts of the world. As you can see, this is Stonehenge, before that the pyramids, and as you can see, the temple period falls just about the time of it starts before the earliest pyramids, but Tarsian, for example, coincides with the earliest pyramids. And this is probably Mesopotamian tablet here, with writings on it, with inscription on it, and this is one of the, I think it's New Grange or Notes in Ireland, which is slightly earlier than our megalithic temples. And of course everybody recognizes Stonehenge, and finally, towards the end of the Bronze Age, the so-called Mask of Agamemnon, which was found in the shaft tombs at Mycenae. And then, of course, we have the historical period, the ancient historical period, which covers the Phoenician for the Maltese islands, the Phoenicians, followed by the Carthaginians, we call it Punic period, and then the Roman. This is the period that I shall be covering in my overview. We start off by illustrating just one object, one amulet belonging to the Neolithic period, that is covering three phases: Ardalan phase, Great phase, Corba phase, and Red Scorba phase. And the object that I have selected was found in a hut, actually in two huts connected together by a common courtyard, which from the objects found in it has revealed that it had a non-secular and therefore religious role. And we call it the Red Scorba Shrine, so belonging to the last phase of the Neolithic. And of course, you can see for yourselves why we selected, we define it as a likely amulet, because it is phallic shape, but it is only a cow tooth, so it's a very inexpensive object found quite easily. It's not exotic, but that makes it even more significant in terms of the symbolism, the sacred symbolism. It was intended to be inserted in a necklace, because instead of a hole for a string to pass through that hole to the perforation, it has a groove at the top, giving it an even more phallic shape. I should say that for the whole of the Neolithic, starting from Ardalan to the Red Scorba phase, there have been found quite a good selection of dark green stone, which were pendants, but these are likely to have been simply trinkets and valued for their exotic value, because they were imported. This green stone, we know, originated in southern Italy, in Calabria. The Red Scorba Shrine yielded also a perforated cowrie shell. And since it is perforated, it was intended as a pendant. So I move straight away to the second period of prehistory, namely the Temple period. And I should call your attention to the fact that in the first two phases, we do not have any temple structures. Temples start to be built in the Gigantia phase, and of course the culture reaches its apogee, its climax, in the Tarsian period, which ends around 2500, when it suddenly collapses, it suddenly disappears. But I don't have the time to go into that question. So some examples. I said that in the first two phases there are no temples. They start being built in the Gigantia phase, but starting from the very first phase of this second of the temple period, we have underground structures dedicated to the disposal of the dead, deceased. Therefore, funerary architecture. We start off with just chambers, underground chambers, like this one, accessible through a shaft from the surface. I'm going to start with this, that is a combination of two chambers found at the Chara Circle in Gozo, which was excavated between 1997 and, between 1987 and 1994. Here you can see the two. Well, here's just one chamber here and another chamber on this side, served by a common shaft. So just two small chambers, large enough to fit one person, but inside it as many as 65 individuals must have been buried, in succession. Each time, in order to make space, of course, the bulkier bones had to be disposed of, be removed. But when it was excavated, archaeologists, having excavated the site very carefully, retrieved everything, even small bones of the human body, and by adding bones that occur once in a body, they could calculate that inside those two chambers as many as 65 individuals must have been buried. And what I'm showing here are just 8 pendants. We think they are amulets that were buried with their owners, with the deceased owners, and there are only a selection of about 26 such amulets. And as you can see, that they vary in shape from just one bulge to 2 bulges and 3 bulges, which make them a bit more like a human body, more anthropomorphic. And this shape, it is this shape that makes us think that they are bone amulets. We call it the Zerbuch phase tomb because in terms of dating, it belongs to the earliest phase of that period. Right, okay, you notice the holes, of course, for hanging. And as I said, they do look like an abstract human body. These are 4 others. Perhaps this one is, and these 2 are the most likely, the most likely candidates for a human shape, an anthropomorphic shape. And from such modest beginnings, underground funerary architecture develops until, in the last phase of the temple period, Trajan phase, they become huge underground communal cemeteries. And we have 2 examples of such communal cemeteries. The first one that was excavated, that was discovered and cleared, excavated, was the Halsafliedi Hypogeum, the Hypogeum in Paola, which was discovered at the beginning of the 20th century, unfortunately without proper scientific methodology and without proper records, or if records were kept, they have not survived for various reasons, various circumstances. As you can see, it is a very complex underground system, all or almost all, man-made, engraved by human hands, human tools, as opposed to the Gozer one that I shall be illustrating later on. The unfortunate thing about it is that we don't have proper records where things were found. And the Hypogeum did produce quite an abundance of pendants, especially of the green stone, dark green stone type, very often axe-shaped, and therefore we think that they were originally axes used, remember we're on the Stone Age, used for material purposes, and eventually when they became too small, they assumed the role of pendants. They were worn on the person. Right, this is a view everybody's familiar, everybody has seen once in their lifetime pictures of the Hypogeum, but of course the object of the purpose of the talk this evening is different. And here is an example of an amulet, again, a bone, an amulet, an animal bone, amulet found in the Halsafliedi Hypogeum. And again, it looks like a human being. It does suggest symbolically the shape of a human being. Whereas the green stone pendants were probably simply personal ornaments, unless they had a meaning which escapes us. I now take you to Gozo, where a similar contemporary hypogeum, communal underground communal cemetery was discovered and excavated between 1987 and 1994, and therefore with the state of the art methodology, recording every object and within its context. However, it is quite different. As you can see, it was originally a system of natural caves whose roof, natural roof, at some time, at some occasion, collapsed. And therefore, we as archaeologists had to remove tons of boulders from the roof, the collapsed roof, in order to reach the archaeological levels, the cultural levels. And you can see that they were consisted of a series of chambers on the side, with a central area probably for some ceremonial rituals connected with the preparation of the body of the deceased for burial. Inside the natural caves, there were also some megalithic structures, as you can see here. In fact, I have shown you already the artistic reconstruction when I pointed out only these tombs here. But now we move on to the larger complex. So we can see these chambers, natural chambers, gravitating around this central part, which was adorned with cult objects like this large stone jars and statuary, and also some articulated skeletons still in place. This is the now Shara Circle or Shara Hypogeum. Contemporary, I repeat, contemporary with the previous one. As many as 200,000 human bone fragments were added, and identified and studied, but the total number of persons they represent is about 800. So I think the estimate of about 7,000 individuals buried in the Hypogeum probably has to be rethought, to be redimensioned. Mostly bones scattered all over the place, loose or partial articulation, one hand here, one leg there, but very rarely entire skeletons in place, what we call primary deposition. Okay, the primary depositions which eventually remained in place, about 10 skeletons in all, and here we see two of them, one on top of the other, right? And of course, again, our concern is not the skeletons. That's another story, but amulets, okay, pendants and amulets, and two objects which are now rarely seen and are quite unusual, even in the prehistoric context for the temple period, are these two pendants, which have a particular shape. And of course, you can see anything in them. If I were, perhaps you're not familiar with the name of Maria Gimbutas, who became almost a cult figure herself for the feminine movement, especially in archaeological terms. She would have seen an uterus, a representation of a uterus. But of course, our prehistoric ancestors were not versed in anatomy. I don't think they practiced dissection, and therefore they would not have known what a uterus looked like. In any case, you can imagine also a female body as well, right? We think, and this is the material is only pottery, you know, very cheap material. So the symbolic value must have been quite great. But it's difficult for us, because of lack of textual evidence, textual information, to guess what the purpose of these amulets was. Also accompanying the skeletal remains in the Gozo Hypogeum were a series of really minute busts, you might call them busts. Can you imagine that this one is that one, and it's only 2.5 centimeters high, about that high, right? So the others are even smaller. I think you would have needed a lens to be able to carve such heads. Okay, the aesthetic quality is not always very, very pleasant, as you can see. But again, these are likely to have been amulets, but they don't have perforations, but they could have been wound by a string just underneath the head. Otherwise, it's difficult to tell what the original purpose was. But from the Gozo Hypogeum, quite a large series of seashells were also discovered, were retrieved, many of them with perforations, as you can say, and therefore they qualify as pendants. But as I said again, since they do not have intrinsic value, material value, just seashells, they are likely to have had an amuletic value, which escapes us. The purpose escapes us. Here we have a cowrie, here we have a ton shell. Now we leave the funerary underworld, the underground world of the dead, and we move up to the structures above, to the temples above, where, in my view, the rituals of life were practiced. And here I'm limiting myself to illustrate one particular building, the Tarshin temples. And remember, Tarshin temples, it's a complex of at least about four temples, if we include this one here, but three are evident here. And I'm presenting this particularly because it is the temple which is richest in terms of amulets and other objects of cult, sacred objects, but more so because it was the first of such temples that was excavated properly at the beginning of the 20th century by Themistocles, but soon after the Hypogeum. And as you can see, Themistocles Zamit kept a very good record of the place where the objects were found, and therefore a good contextual evidence. And I call your attention to the letters A, which stand for amulets. And the first one here, of course, this is the first two chambers of the Tarshin temples, which is the most decorated and probably accessible to a greater number of the population. So decorated with spirals all around, and is dominated by the huge colossal statue, the so-called fat personage. Here we have just one there, and another one found in debris here. This is, would be the debris between the two walls. But the presence of an amulet there, and a phallic symbol, for example, there, leads us to believe that in that chamber some sort of ritual took place, possibly connected with initiation rites. Okay? And the other area I'd like to call your attention to is this one, which is the space between the inner wall of the eastern temple and the outer wall, that kept the structure together. This space was emptied and was used for some ritual purpose. And since there are perforations here, in the past, traditionally, reference to oracle holes has been made. It has been interpreted as the practice of oracular pronouncements. But the presence of so many amulets, oracle room, as you can see, the presence of so many amulets suggests also that there was a passage rather than verbal pronouncements, the passage of offerings, votive offerings made by the faithful to the person behind that hole. Okay, so just to the intention is to bring out the importance of the context. Some examples of amulets found at Tarshil. This is a very small bead which is on exhibit here. By the way, even that sort of fiddle-like amulet is also on exhibit, and you find it illustrated in the catalog. This is a small bead in veined stone that looks like alabaster, but although it's not visible here, it has a hole perforating it through the vertical axis from top to bottom. So it qualifies as a pendant and therefore probably also as an amulet. A curious amulet, again having its two perforations here, V-shaped perforations this time. This is one V-shaped perforation and this is another one, therefore intended to probably be strung in a some sort of necklace rather than hung from somewhere. The curious thing about it is that it seems to represent a temple. It's a model of a typical megalithic temple of the time. We have several models of different sizes found in this context, including in Tarshil. But this is the very smallest one. So in fact, Evans calls it amulet, and Zammit identifies the material as dark crystalline calcite. So it's a local material. Calcite is made up of from water deposits. Another curious object on exhibit here. Of course, if it was hung that way vertically, if you hide the right hand one, the repositioning of the same object, it would be difficult to make sense of. But if you turn it round in this way, it looks very much like an abstract image of an animal. We don't know what type of animal, but it does look like an animal. Now we move on to the next phase, or rather the next period of Maltese prehistory, namely the bronze that incorporates the Iron Age. You know, there is a problem, these question marks here, what happened to this civilization, this culture, this very rich culture, which expressed itself in temples and the art that went into it, which simply disappears rather suddenly. There is not a progressive decline. And eventually it is replaced by a new people. A new people with new technology, new pottery, new way of conceiving the human body, on the other hand, a new culture, new people that do not care about building megalithic structures, and so on. So this is still a mystery. And carrying bronze, it is technologically more advanced because they carried metal. And for this, now first of all, this is a familiar plan, that's the same plan as previous, that is the Tarshil temples. I should clarify that the area that was occupied in this second period as a cremation cemetery was just this area here. Alright, so the Bronze Age people came and found the structure probably already abandoned and collapsed, and they reused part of it in order to place their cemetery. And a cemetery of a different type than previously, that is a cremation cemetery in which people were actually, the bodies of the deceased were burnt and the bones were placed in containers, in pottery containers. Okay, and some of the material that was deposited with these charred human remains are thousands, about 3,000 of disc beads, very small, very tiny disc beads, either blue of blue faience, and in some cases also ostrich eggshell, both of which are foreign to the Maltese islands. Blue glass faience was never produced in Malta until modern times, and of course ostrich eggshell derived from Africa, possibly not directly from North Africa, from our neighbors in North Africa, but through a very intensive traffic that took place in this time, mostly by the so-called Mycenaeans, that is the Proto-Greeks, the inhabitants of the Greek area, the Aegean area, at this time. So, yes, these were, collected into necklaces. You can see hundreds, if not thousands, and also some pendants added onto them. A curious object found at Tarshian, but it is not clear in which level, but I have reason to believe that it was found in this level of the Bronze Age, because this period is contemporary with the rise of scripts, of written scripts, written language in the Near East and in the Eastern Mediterranean. And that is this bead, which is made of very dark green stone, therefore also imported, but it is inlaid with gold. Again, metal would clearly place it in this period rather than in the previous Tarshian phase. So it's Tarshian cemetery. It has, as you can see, incised linear designs, including the same one, the same design, this one, that is found on a pebble pendant and also on a pottery fragment. That is a horizontal bar with three vertical signs, with vertical lines from it. And I think this is a sort of a codified sign, which is at least associated or similar to some written scripts, which still has to be identified. There are also three holes around it with gold lining, as you can see, outline, and originally they contained gemstones, one of which, a red one, survives. Not here, but round the corner. Also, from the same Tarshian cemetery, is this bird amulet, about this size, about 3 centimeters in, or 4 centimeters in length, which also has a hole. Apparently, it has a hole at the which pierced from a swelling down here at the bottom to the top, which is not visible here. But again, this is just pottery. What the significance is, we do not know. Finally, we move on to the historical period. I think I have to make it faster. I don't have the numbers of these slides. The Phoenician and Phoenician. As you know, the Phoenicians moved into Malta around the middle of the 8th century, or the latter part of the 8th century, in order, because Malta was a very convenient stopping place for them. Eventually, like many other outposts in the Western Mediterranean, it became a colony, fully fledged colony of the Phoenicians. And once here, eventually their descendants formed part of the Western Phoenician world, which gravitated around the most prosperous and the most powerful city, Carthage. So we ended up forming part of the Carthaginian empire until in 218, the Romans, who were also became enemies of the Carthaginians, They conducted three extended wars during the beginning of the Second Punic War in 218. The Romans actually invaded, took over Malta, and Malta became part of the Roman Empire. Okay, so from about 700 to 218, Phoenician Punic, and from 218 onwards, Roman. Right, the methodology for the historical period changes slightly. For this, the whole of this period, we have textual evidence now, so we have commentators, we have textual evidence, we are in a better position to identify the meaning of the objects, what they represent. The material becomes more often expensive and even exotic. Here we have an example, gold, of course, and the iconography is fundamental. The iconography is much more explicit. As you can see here, the human body is not abstract, but materialistic. In this case, these two personalities carry animal heads, and therefore we can identify them as Egyptian gods, as we shall see in a moment. Right, and of course, again, the context. For this period, we have domestic. We do have domestic context. We have one fully developed, fully fledged house, domus, townhouse, and we have a number of villas, houses in the countryside. Cultic places of worship. We have one site, the Tassij site, which I shall illustrate later on, which has been excavated, fully excavated. It was never excavated before. It was excavated in the 1960s, and now, or even still being excavated, as well as a good number of about 500 tombs, also underground, rock cut underground. So we have all those contexts. And to illustrate a few of these, we have this solid gold amulet from a rock cut tomb, underground tomb, at Ain Klib, just outside Rabat, which shows, which illustrates the Egyptian gods Horus and Anubis, who are very popular gods in the Egyptian pantheon. The Egyptian pantheon is full of, there are hundreds of divinities, and these are two of the most popular ones. Anubis is normally connected with funerary rituals, whereas Horus is more connected with life, with aspects of life. This goes back to about the 6th or possibly even 7th century BC, so soon after the introduction of the Phoenicians in Malta. Whole selection about 31 amulets are known or are reported, let's put it that way, to have been found at this site here, at the site called Tal Horob in the limits of Shawkiya in Gozo. But we have a problem here. There is only one record of an archaeological discovery at the site called Tal Horob, recorded in the museum annual reports, and that is in 1951. But the record mentions only a wall accompanied by pottery of the Roman period. And obviously these are not Roman period, these belong to the Phoenician and Punic period. So we can only rely on the authority of one person who is now dead, unfortunately, Dr. Tancred Gooder, who published them in a magazine for the first time in 1989, as coming all from Tal Horob in Gozo. An Austrian expert in this area of so-called Egyptiaca, that is of Egyptian objects, has published books of Egyptian objects all over the Mediterranean, a certain Günther Hölbel, published a book about Maltese Egyptiaca, and he concluded that since these are normally found in tombs, they must have come from a tomb in the area of Tal Hora. But we have still to confirm that. And you can see there are various personalities here, anthropomorphic amulets, as well as a whole series of amulets representing the eye. I shall illustrate them individually. This is the Ujjad, so-called Ujjad amulet, also known as the Eye of Horus. Now, and on the right, you have a selection of similar ones, different materials. These are mostly faience, that is, glass-paste. Again, the workmanship, the crafts, did not belong to Malta. It was never practiced in Malta in antiquity, and therefore all these were imported probably from Egypt. Now, tell me, what has Egypt got to do with Malta? I have mentioned only the Phoenicians. It's because the Phoenicians were great traders and mariners, of course, and they adopted a lot. They imported a lot of Egyptian objects. They made them their own. It seems that even Egyptian beliefs were taken over by the Phoenicians and circulated around the whole Mediterranean, in particular in the Western Mediterranean, including Malta. So these are the amulets intended to ward off evil, again with the eye of the god Horus. Let me just say a word that I think time is running out. So the eyes that we see on our boats, you know, especially Marsha Flocketsa, has nothing to do with the eye of Horus. It's an eye that you can find also on ancient Greek boats, on illustrations of ancient Greek boats, so it has nothing to do with the Ujjat eyes. this is an interesting god Bes, who is very grotesque and monstrous. He's a dwarf. You can see some better preserved ones in the Ashmolean Museum. The ones that you see on the right are in the Ashmolean Museum. And funnily enough, he was a protector of women and children. So he was a dwarf god, as I said. He was a complex being, was both a deity as well as a demonic fighter. He was a god of war, yet he was also patron of childbirth and was associated with sexuality, humor, music, and dancing. He was very popular with everyday Egyptian people because he protected women and children above all others. If the mother was experiencing a difficult birth, a statue of Bes was placed near her head and his assistance was invoked on her behalf. Rather sweetly, I find, Bes remained at the child's side after birth to protect and entertain them. It was said that if a baby laughed or smiled for no reason, it was because Bes was pulling funny faces. I found that very interesting and very sweet. And this is how he would have looked like in a larger size. We have this statue in marble in a Maltese collection, probably from Maltese origin, rather run down, rather corroded, but here we have a better version found in the Cambridge Archaeological Museum. And even he, even this one is, as you can see, wearing an amulet in the shape of a lion's head. This is a lion's head, and therefore we can see the comparison. Right, other amulets representing different gods. From Talibraj Gozo we have this ibis, a god in the shape of ibis, representing Thoth. From Mtarpa, an amulet representing an ape with its hands to her mouth, and another amulet representing a divinity which is half Ra and half Horus. Therefore, it's normally referred to as Re Horakhti. I think I'm going to move fast. Apart from pendants, amulets were also placed in on rings, especially these strange Egyptian items called scarabs, the upside of which were in the carved in the shape of a beetle. The beetle had a great symbolism for the Egyptians, and on the flat underside you would have magical formulas or representations from Egyptian mythology. This is another one in the collection here. These are all in the collection exhibited here. One very important amulet found in Malta with the fine spot recorded is the Talvil II amulet, found in a Venetian tomb in a private house, the house of the Honorable Mikalev, Daniel Mikalev, who gave it to the museum, inside which there's a bronze cartouche, a stuccio, inside which there was a tiny piece of papyrus. This is a papyrus about this size. Right? This is very, very small. And on the papyrus we have this written inscription in Punic, and the image of Isis, again Egyptian Isis, one of the most popular Egyptian divinities, with this inscription that I reproduce in English. Yeah, Wrath, laugh at your enemy, obedient ones, scorn, assail, crush your adversary this day. It is known that this is very similar to a text found in Egypt, the book of the dead, and therefore again emphasizing the Egyptian influence. Now, very quickly, objects, amulets found in context, in recorded context, by our department, the excavations run by our department at the site of Tassilj. This is an aerial view of Tassilj. I'm sure you're familiar with it. As you can see, the site is divided into two by a road cutting into it, and we of the department limited our excavation to just three small holes here, this one here, and you can compare to the huge excavated site, the site excavated by the Italians in the 1960s. Here we are, these are our three trenches. In spite of that, in spite of the smallness of our excavation, we managed to retrieve as many as six amulets and three scarabs. And here you can see the methodology we used. We spent hours removing one layer after another. And here are the scarabs. These scarabs, I shall go into detail individually later on. This one shows the beetle, as you can see, the back. The first two scarabs are in a special type of stone, which is found in Egypt. Right now, it escapes me. I shall come later on. But on the underside, you can see rather sort of in an abstract way, almost modern representation of Isis fronted by her son Horus. Perhaps the next one is more interesting, although fragmentary, you see part of it is missing. It is clear that it represents Isis covered by a thicket and suckling her son Horus. You see here, a grown-up child, remember? Whereas this is in glass paste, that was in stone, dark stone. This is in glass paste. Again, the beetle, but the underside has not been identified properly. And as I said, six amulets. All right. Again, very, very small. All these are very small, except for the monkey here. This monkey is I don't know whether we can call it amulet, because it's about 6 centimeters in height and doesn't have any loops or holes for hanging. All these were votive offerings, where they were offered in the temple at Tassilj. So, a writing tablet, that's how they call it, although I think a scholar made a good case for identifying it as the end of a transformation process of a ptah, Hataikus, a god, a human being, a dwarf, standing on two crocodiles, from anthropomorphic to a geometric form. but again, it's a very detailed subject. Again, we have an Ujjat. This is one Ujjat, one side and the other, the opposite side. We have another monkey here, seated monkey. These are parallels found again in other museums. I think this is the British Museum. Just this head, this is what we found at Tassilj, just the head here. This is the front view, and this is the side view, as you can see, the loop. But it can be integrated in this type of figure, the figure of Ptah, which is Ptahikos, which is also represented, exhibited in the exhibition here. And here are some parallels, again, from the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. We have also a headless pendant of a cat, typical of Egyptian goddess Bastet, represented as cat. This is a beautiful piece of, we're very, very satisfied, very happy when it was discovered. It's also in glass paste and has some traces of the original skin, green skin, green color. And here is a parallel, again found with a baboon, found in the Ashmolean Museum. An interesting object, again a pendant, but possibly not an amulet in this case, because it's more like a piece of jewelry. It is, in actual fact, a female head in pottery, therefore a cheap material, but gilt. My interpretation is that the owner was not rich enough to offer a golden piece of jewelry, and she presumably could offer a substitute, a gilt substitute. I think I have to skip this last bit. Just very quickly, we have a curious statue in marble that was known already in the 17th century. It stood in the Medina gates, because Avella records it there, but apart from being Hellenistic, it has a curious hairstyle which identifies it along with this knot here as Isis, representation again Egyptian Isis, but very likely syncretized, absorbed with the goddess, finishing goddess Ashtart, so Ashtart Isis. But what is curious and unique about this is this sort of necklace, very complicated necklace or pectoral carried on her chest. It's lines of heads of rams, ram heads, rosettes here, and these two curious birds fronting each other. Unfortunately, it's not from a good context. And to emphasize the Egyptian content, even in the Roman period, because we have now moved into the Roman period, no longer in the Phoenician Punic period, the Roman period, there is this relief here, fragment relief, that is kept in a private collection about which I have done a study, and suggested its origin in the Tassilj complex, because a piece of marble was found during the Italian excavations in 1960s, which is exactly this part here. And surely enough, an article published recently by an Italian scholar has published more bits of a similar frieze belonging to different parts of the same. So this was part of a long frieze. And just to show you what the symbolism is, there are other friezes, other relief plaques, which show that these two serpents here, the cobra and the snake, normal snake, had probably human heads, human heads of gods. Isis Termutis, as she's called, and Serapis, her companion, in Hellenistic and Roman times. Finally, the Roman Domus, which was previously called wrongly the Roman Villa of Rabat, discovered in 1881, as you can see here, produced also an object which is the only one that shows the wearing of an amulet. And it is a typically togged statue, but of a small size, representing a child. And in fact, this child is carrying a bulla, a sort of disc-shaped amulet that was carried by children before they entered into the adult world and shedding off the bulla, all right, and became entered into the adult world. They became adults. And just to complete the whole picture, although this statue is headless, the circumstantial evidence, it is part of a cycle of sculpture found in the Roman Domus, including a clearly defined statue of Emperor Claudius, who reigned between 41 and 54 AD. This statue of a young boy could not be other than the adopted son of Claudius, son of the last wife of Claudius, Agrippina, and therefore who eventually succeeded Claudius as Emperor Nero. So here we have a statue of a child Nero. That brings me to the end of my presentation. I apologize for going beyond the limits, time limits. I don't know whether we have any time for questions. Thank you for your attention. Yes?
Just one question. I'm just curious to know that if the amulets you showed us, the very early amulets, mm-hmm. is there anything comparable that has been found in the Mediterranean?
The very first one?
The really early ones.
Yes, the tooth, the cow tooth.
Or is it something that's only been found in Malta?
Oh, no. Yes, the use of animal bones and animal teeth is quite universal. I'm sure you must have come across illustrations of primitive African individuals or South American individuals with piercings all over the place, ears and so on. And the animal teeth were also, yes, quite commonly used for this purpose, for their amuletic some sort of external special power. They must have had they must have been attributed with some sort of spiritual power.
Well, thank you, Professor Bonanno. That was really a fascinating talk, and in fact, I just didn't see the time passing. Thank you so much. I think you've really explained well and brought to life the amulets that we have displayed in the first room in the exhibition, which I'd encourage you to go and visit. Even if you've already seen them, I'm sure you'll see them with fresh insights now that Professor Bonanno has explained them, most of them, to us. To 9 o'clock this evening, so there's ample time to visit. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum entitled Vanity, Profanity and Worship. This talk was delivered by Professor Anthony Bonanno.